So, Renu, we're welcoming a friend of the podcast back today, aren't we?
A friend of the podcast. And actually, this is his first in-person visit to the studio. I think the first was over Zoom, which was good at that time, but wonderful to have guests in the studio. And what a great one we have today.
Yeah, we sure do. It was November last year, one of our most popular podcasts of all time, called Patting the Hormonal Therapy Shark. We'll include a link at the end and down in the show notes. But it was a very impactful episode of the podcast in lots of different ways. We had amazing feedback from clinicians, from industry, from patients, from lots of different people. And I kind of knew that the minute we posted it that we're going to need a follow-up. And yeah. So here we are almost a year later having a follow-up with Tim Baker, author Tim Baker, a friend of the podcast. Great to have you back, Tim.
Thanks,
great,
Declan.
Great to see you.
Great to see you, Tim.
So nice to see you too.
Yeah. Author, journalist, surfer, so many titles.
We'll get
influencer.
To all that. We sure is. And he's been busy since then, but we'll get to all that. But so this is one of our themed podcasts. Regular listeners will know we have some fantastic partners who support GUcast, support the running of this podcast, keeps us going all the time. And one of those is Mundi Pharma, big pharmaceutical company who work a lot in the area of prostate cancer. They're one of our gold partners. And so in discussing with them what sort of themed episode we might find that is of mutual interest to industry and to ourselves, well, this was kind of an obvious one to go for because their main interest is in androgen deprivation therapy. And for any of you who've listened to that previous podcast, we'll backtrack a bit on it today. You'll understand that androgen deprivation therapy is a really important theme for us. So this is a themed podcast supported by Mundi Pharma, and we're grateful for them for supporting things we do.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Because, because of their support, we're able to get these important messages out to, you know, the urology community and also the wider GU oncology community, including patients and people who've been affected personally by prostate cancer.
So, Patting the Shark. Those of you watching on YouTube can see I'm holding up this book. This is the book that Tim wrote about his own personal experience, and we titled our episode last year, Patting the Hormonal Therapy Shark. It is a fantastic read. I read it myself and bought a bunch of copies to give to other people, including you, last year. So I highly recommend this for anyone who's working in the field of prostate cancer, survivor, anyone who knows anyone with prostate cancer. It's a brilliantly written story by a very talented writer, because that's what Tim does. Tim is he's a writer and author, and your particular expertise, Tim, is in surfing.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that, just for those not familiar?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've edited surfing magazines, and I've written a bunch of books, biographies of well-known surfers like Mick Fanning and Mark Occhialupo, and a history of Australian surfing. Around Australia road trip I did with my family called Safari.
Yeah, I got that book for Christmas last
year. Yeah. So Patting the Shark was a bit of a departure from my normal stock in trade, but there's still a bit of a surfing theme running through it. And in fact, the title, you know, is sort of drawn from a surfing experience. Surfing's been really good to me. I often say I've never been more grateful to be a surfer and to be a writer than since my diagnosis. Like, those two things have been remarkable tools for me in terms of processing the diagnosis and, I guess, managing all the challenges along the way.
And look, we don't want to go all deep into that whole story again. You told it brilliantly the last time, but I suppose we better, in summary, for those who haven't gone back, and just tell us a little bit in brief about your prostate cancer journey, which led to writing this fantastic book.
Sure. So, diagnosed July 7, 2015 with metastatic prostate cancer. I had my PSA was 120, Gleason score 9, had lesions in my right femur, left 7th rib. You know, the prognosis was pretty grim. I was pretty freaked out. And, there was just a really steep learning curve in terms of, I guess, understanding the treatment options and then how to manage side effects of treatment. And I'm not quite sure why, but sort of I guess I just became really proactive about how I was going to, you know, navigate this journey, and learned a lot along the way and had some really great support and allies. And I guess that whole world of allied health in terms of maintaining quality of life and mitigating side effects became a particular focus of mine. And, you know, the book was part of a creative writing PhD, so I just really immersed myself in that whole world.
And, and Tim, writing this book must have sort of almost catapulted you into sort of another world of prostate cancer and dealing with clinicians and patients, not just for yourself, but you've sort of become, you know, almost like a pillar of support for other patients, the person that people, you know, physicians and nurses and other allied health services look to for information and sort of a different perspective. What's it been like since his book came out?
Extraordinary. Way beyond anything I could have imagined. Like, I expected patients to respond to the book, you know, who were going through a similar experience. If anything, I wasn't expecting the sort of response I've had from the medical community. If anything, I thought there might be a bit of pushback, like, who does this guy think he is questioning mainstream medicine? And, you know, but people like yourselves have just been so welcoming and open, and I've been so grateful for that. And I think I've been the beneficiary of kind of good timing, in a sense, that there is this sort of groundswell of, you know, listening to the patient experience and the patient voice. And so I think my book came along at a good time when people were really receptive to that kind of message. Yeah.
So the last time we talked about your experience of being diagnosed and the really devastating effects of androgen deprivation therapy, Tim, in your 50, you were 49, I think, when you were diagnosed.
50.
Yeah. And so we talked about that a lot the last day, but a key part of the book and about your communication since then is about your strategies, self-developed, which is humbling for us to hear as clinicians, because we should be developing these, but self-developed strategies. So we wanted to talk a little bit today about those, and you had the acronym MEDS, M-E-D-S, that summarizes these. But we'd love to hear a little bit more today about MEDS and indeed about other strategies, other advice you might have for people, because we want to work with industry, with other clinicians, allied healthcare. We want to work with governments to try and put in place these strategies. And I think reading and listening to your experiences is very helpful for us in trying to go forward with that.
Oh, look, yeah, I'm so grateful. As I said, you know, all these opportunities that have come along in the wake of the book. You know, mate, you write a book and in my experience, you might get 1 or 2 months of media to kind of get you work out and promote the book. I've had a solid 12 months of people wanting me to talk about this book, from cancer conferences to patient forums to, you know, all podcasts to TV shows. I've never done so much media in my life, you know, but it's been an incredible opportunity to get the message out, and it's been so warmly received that, yeah, I just feel so grateful that...
And I think the beauty of you know, the strategies that you've developed and that acronym MEDS is it doesn't just apply to prostate cancer patients. I mean, it can apply to anyone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And especially someone who's dealing with a chronic illness and dealing with side effects of a medication that they may have to take on and off for the rest of their lives.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think that's why it hits people on so many different levels and so many different people.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, being a writer and a journalist, you know, like, my job is, and my craft is, kind of wordplay.
Yeah.
So, and also it's like synthesizing large amounts of technical information and trying to make it in really accessible to a general audience. And so I feel like that's what I kind of did for myself with my self-care. Like, I was just reading so much and trying to learn, and that I was kind of suffering information overload myself. Like, what should I be doing? What should I be eating? And what supplements should I be taking? And I, at some point I went, I just got to simplify this all down to something that's just a really easy kind of mantra.
Yeah.
And it became, I've just got to take my meds, MEDS, which is...
So tell us, what is MEDS?
MEDS. MEDS for dummies.
Which stands for meditation, exercise, diet and sleep. And I always am very keen to provide the qualifier that, you know, that's to sit alongside conventional medicine.
Yeah.
I'm not promoting, you know, miracle, you know, spurious alternative cures. I'm a great believer in medical science. But this is very much about, you know, managing side effects of treatment and maintaining quality of life. And those four things, meditation, exercise, diet and sleep, just became the four pillars of my self-care. And they work in conjunction in a lot of ways to address pretty much all the side effects of hormone therapy. And 8 years on, I've got a great quality of life. I'm really healthy and happy, and I'm still doing all the things I've always done, surfing and writing and traveling. And I did not think that was going to be the case when I received my diagnosis. So I feel like that's kind of proof's in the pudding, in a sense, that these things have been really helpful to me, and I would imagine they could be helpful for other people.
Shall we run through them? Shall we? So MEDS, just give us a few tips, and we'll put some links in. We did for the previous episode as well. But how do you do meditation
how
for
do
people
you start?
Out there?
Yeah.
How do you start? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was lucky. I had some experience with meditation, and I do hear a lot of people expressing a kind of resistance to the idea of meditation, and I think it just needs demystifying, because it's really, really simple. And I just don't believe anyone who says they can't meditate, because we all have busy minds. You know, we all know that experience of the monkey mind jumping around from one thing to another. And in essence, it's just focusing on the breath.
Yeah.
And allowing thoughts to come and go and not focus on them. And so when people go, I can't meditate, my mind is too busy, it's like, well, that's why you meditate, because the mind is busy.
Yeah.
And when you notice the mind wandering, you just bring it back to the breath. And when you everyone who starts meditating, the mind wanders.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a reason to say you can't meditate. So if you're focusing on the air moving in and out of the nostrils and you kind of start feeling a sense of peace and stillness, and then your mind wanders to, oh, what am I going to do at work on Monday? You just bring it back to the breath. And if that's happening every 3 seconds, you're getting lots of practice.
Yeah.
Because the practice is noticing the mind wander and bring it back to
the
breath.
It's that awareness, isn't it?
Yeah.
That your mind is wandering.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, there's lots of traditions, and I think it is good to have some sort of meditation tradition. I follow the Vipassana meditation tradition, which is quite, I guess it's quite challenging in some sense, because it's sort of based around these 10-day silent meditation retreats, which is not going to be for everyone, I hasten to add. But it was something that I'd had some experience in prior to my diagnosis, and it became just such a valuable tool. And I'd have a daily practice, and then it wasn't quite every year, but every couple of years I'd go back and do another 10-day retreat just to kind of solidify my practice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could just have a place of peace and stillness I could drop into and not have to live with that cycling anxiety of, you know, I've got a scan coming up, or I've got a blood test coming up. And I would sleep soundly the night before blood tests or scans or oncology appointments. I'd forget that I had an oncology appointment the next day. Yeah. I wasn't lying awake at night tossing and turning. So there was such a tangible benefit. I just was encouraged to kind of take my practice deeper and deeper. And I honestly don't know how people manage a cancer diagnosis without some kind of tool like that, because the anxiety is pretty oppressive if you don't find a way to come to terms with it. And for me, meditation was how I managed to come to terms with it.
And I think the resistance a lot of people have with meditation is that it seems like an extra thing to do. But in fact, it's actually dropping everything and doing nothing.
So,
and it could be 10 minutes. It doesn't have to be a 10-day silent retreat.
Exactly. You
know? 10 minutes a day would be a great start for, for the majority
and
of people.
And it can be anything you do. I mean, for some people, gardening is meditative.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it's really anything that helps quieten the intellectual mind and helps still all those cycling anxieties. And, you know, people talk about, you know, you find yourself in traffic sitting at a red light. Just focus on the breath for a few breaths. Don't curse the red light. Here's like a little window in your day where you can just practice a bit of stillness.
Yeah.
And so, I just try and integrate that into my everyday.
Yeah.
And I do have a quite solid daily practice now, but it's a pleasure, you know. And if I don't do it, I notice it and I'm not running as well, you know.
Yeah.
And that's when I'll kind of get tripped up and find myself getting a bit anxious.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, yeah, I didn't meditate this morning. So, and I don't do, you know, I used to do like 2 hours a day, an hour morning and night. And now I might do 20 or 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But I think as long as you've got an established practice, and you say, as I say, it could be 5 or 10 minutes, but just something in your day and get a taste for it.
Yeah.
And then just see where it takes you. And I think your natural inclinations when something's bringing you a benefit is just to kind of continue.
Doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And are there professional resources you use for that, or people you go to, or is it largely self-taught, Tim?
For people out there
listening who've no experience.
Sure. I mean, a good starting point, and I think we spoke about this last time, is there's lots of guided meditations online. I like one called a Yoga Nidra, which is about a 10-minute guided meditation. And you could Google Yoga Nidra and find dozens of YouTube clips or recordings to guide you. And you can lie or sit and just listen to this voice. And it sort of takes you through a sort of body scan from the top of your head to the tip of your toes and back again, just relaxing every part of the body while focusing on the breath. And if you lie down, some people fall asleep, and that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, you sit generally in meditation so you don't fall asleep. But, you know, if you fall asleep, then maybe you need a nap, you know. I just would encourage people to start baby steps, you know, a 5 or 10 minute guided meditation, and just, you know, follow the path that it takes you on,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think your body and mind respond well to, you know, when you're giving them what they need and want. Yeah. And very soon I think you'd find it reasonably effortless and not a chore and just a very welcome part of your day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds nice.
It sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meditation, love it. M.
Yeah.
What's next
yeah.
for new?
E.
Exercise.
What's E? E for exercise. There we yeah. go. And exercise is a tough one, especially for you, because you were always very active.
Yeah.
Surfer.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the diagnosis, ADT hits.
Mm.
And then what was it like for you to get back into that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really, again, that's why I say I'm so grateful to be a surfer, because it's a form of exercise that is so enjoyable.
Yeah.
It's just not a chore. And I know what it's like to kind of go, I should really do something. I should go to the gym, or I should use my weights. And some days, you know, on ADT, you just don't feel like doing it. But even with surfing, as pleasurable as it was, there were days when it was a real effort to kind of go, no, I need to get in the ocean. I can feel it within myself. I just need some ocean time.
Yep.
But I just found if I put my wetsuit on and had my board under my arm, it was just kind of like old muscle memory kicked in.
Yep.
Like, oh, that's it. That's all right. This is what I do.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's such a beautiful kind of resource to have. And it ticks so many boxes, like sitting out the back waiting for a wave, looking at the horizon is quite meditative.
Yeah.
But the, you know, paddling out, duck diving is such a brisk kind of cardio workout, and, you know, sucking big airfuls of oxygen while you're duck diving waves, or, you know, you have a wipe out and get held underwater and come up. You just, you get such a good workout. And then the riding of waves itself is such a bliss experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for me it ticks all those boxes. But exercise, you know, as you'd understand, it also addresses so many of the side effects of ADT.
Yeah.
So, you know, lethargy and fatigue, exercise is the best antidote for that I've found. You know, cardiovascular health, it's good for that. Bone strength, you know, bone density, muscle mass, all those things that are impacted by ADT are all improved by exercise. Mood is improved by exercise. And, you know, as we've said many times, if there was a pill you could take that did for you what exercise does, we'd all be taking it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
so, you know, and it's important because then you just sort of prevent that vicious cycle that happens
yeah.
when you don't exercise, you feel worse, which means you don't exercise, which means you feel worse. And
yeah.
And it's a great way to get you out of that kind of cycle. I mean, I think the medical community have recognized for a long time how beneficial exercise is to all types of chronic disease,
for
in
sure.
particular prostate cancer.
Yeah, but randomized trials absolutely. From Australia have established that exercise
yeah.
has a role. And it's possible to get help with that as well in Australia.
Yeah.
There is support for exercise physiologists to get involved as part of a GP care plan. And many of the ADT companies like Mundi Pharma have exercise programs in place. You know, we have programs where you can get support when you're starting a patient on one of these medications. The pharmaceutical companies like Mundi Pharma have these programs, LE Plus and all these sorts of things that will help. And I must say, you know, for people listening who think, oh, I'm much older than Tim, or I'm not as fit as Tim, or my dad's not as fit as Tim, you know, part of, I know, the message from exercise physiologists is, well, say you're a 78-year-old and you have mobility issues and so on, it doesn't matter. If you just take whatever it is you do, and do a little bit more when you're starting your androgen deprivation therapy, you'll feel better.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it might be just a little bit of supervised resistance training, or
absolutely.
You know, going up and down the stairs a bit more often. So it doesn't have to be I'm training for the marathon or I want to be a surfer
no.
like Tim. The exercise thing can be very tailored to all men starting ADT. So just as you said, Tim,
yeah.
if it was a drug, we'd all be prescribing it. But why we must do, I think for clinicians listening to the podcast, it's like, okay, I'm starting a patient on ADT, or I have someone coming back into my office.
Yeah.
He's been on ADT for a year. He's, you know, he's put on a little bit of weight and he's feeling a bit rubbish. You know, it needs to be, okay, tell us a bit about your exercise. What do you do? Do you like to get out for a walk, or do you go on the bike, or, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and anything that is kind of more than you're currently doing is a good thing. You know, don't feel like you've got to train like a triathlete. I mean, we were talking about my father,
yes.
you know, and he's turning 90, and he was out this morning with his elastic resistance band, you know, doing these exercises. And I was going, go, Dad, you know, at 90.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever you can do that is an improvement on kind of where you're currently at and is going to be a benefit.
I think that is the key message, because people always get nervous. So, you know, I'm too old to do 10,000 steps a day. You don't have to. I mean, if you're doing 2,000, increasing it to 3,000 or 4,000 will be incredibly beneficial for you. Yeah. So it's just a little bit more than what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think if there is an activity that you enjoy, then that's a great way to make sure that you keep coming back to it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, directed or supervised exercise is really good for people on ADT, because that lethargy and fatigue can be a real barrier.
Mm.
And so I've discovered myself, when you've got someone just kind of cracking the whip, you know, I've done exercise studies through University of Queensland, and I've also been a part of their exercise clinic for cancer patients. And when you've got these young, keen exercise physiology students who are like cheering you on the exercise bike, you know, you do a bit better than you would if you're just on your own.
And I think it's an important social interaction
For definitely. People
as well. I think you know, if whether it's a walking club that you belong to or a swimming class or, you know, water yoga or whatever it is, I think there is a certain level of social exposure that you get that you wouldn't if you were just doing something by yourself.
Yeah. And with all those things, as I said, with meditation, when you get a taste and you start getting experiencing the benefit, then you just want to do more. So wherever you start, just, again, baby steps. And if you can, if you've got a care plan, you get referred to an exercise physiologist. I take all my referrals and my care plan each year as exercise physiology, all five of them, because I just think it's the best thing for me.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So for those listening outside Australia, in Australia, we are allowed to put a care plan in place for patients with chronic diseases. And one of those is prostate cancer. Mm. And we are allowed to get up to 5 sessions with a physio or a dietitian or an exercise physiologist per year, which is a good thing. We could do it more. You know, I think we should have more support. But I think, Renu, one of the main issues is we clinicians are not routinely embracing the role of exercise when we start men on androgen deprivation therapy. And there's no point just looking at that patient and say, well, you know, he's very old, he's got all these comorbidities and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, do not underestimate what an exercise physiologist can do. And the pharmaceutical companies have programs in place. And we'll put a link in the show notes. Actually, there's a very good website that lists exercise physiologists around Australia. And actually, as a craft group, I've been really impressed with them. You know, they have taken on board this area of ADT and prostate cancer, and I think they've worked very, very well to do the trials that have shown there's a benefit. Rob Newton and co out in West Australia, but also have good programs in place which cater for men of all ages and abilities. So that's the message for listeners of the podcast: is don't go out this week and just start a patient on ADT or continue the ADT without having to think, you know, exercise is going to really help. And
and I think that message can be especially powerful when it comes from your doctor.
Yeah.
You know, to take on exercises as a way of dealing with the side effects and managing those side effects a lot better. And I think when it comes from a urologist or your oncologist, patients do take that seriously.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I think the person prescribing the treatment, like the ADT, if they're the ones advising on these things that are going to help with side effects, you know, there's a lot of patients who just will do what their doctor tells them, but they might be skeptical about, you know, someone outside of their immediate sort of physician giving them advice, you know, understandably, because there's a lot of spurious advice out there. So,
or their partner's telling them, you should exercise more, you know.
And also you get it when you get a diagnosis like that, all sorts of people are giving you all sorts of advice about all kinds of things. So for it to come from the treating physician, I think, is a really good point. And I think exercise is a no-brainer. It should just be really automatic. You prescribe ADT, you prescribe exercise. Yeah. I just want to see those things hand in hand. That's my big...
I hear you.
I agree.
That's why we brought you back on this
prescribe
podcast.
Exercise.
We
did.
You know, we want to get that message out there.
Yeah.
So we will. M-E, meditation,
D for
exercise.
Diet.
D for diet. Tell us a bit about diet.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I think that was a bit of a vexed one for me, because there are so many different approaches to diet and you get so much different advice. And that was something that kind of bamboozled me at the beginning, you know, like, what should I be eating? And the advice I was given initially was just eat whatever you want, it makes no difference. And I was like, that doesn't sound right, you know. And so, you know, I know what a kind of fraught phrase it is to kind of say, you know, like, do your own research. It's certainly in the post-COVID world, because we all know that, you know, consulting Dr. Google can lead you down some pretty unreliable wormholes.
Yeah.
But there did seem to me to be very clear consensus around the benefits of what I like to call a plant-based diet. So all sorts of different diets were recommended to me, vegan, vegetarian, ketogenic, pescatarian, and you can just really get lost in that whole world. And I like the term plant-based because it's kind of a bit flexible. It just means eat lots of vegetables, eat lots of plants. If you like having a bit of meat or a bit of fish or a bit of chicken, that's okay. You don't want to make this such an onerous thing that it takes all the joy out of life, but you don't have to have a huge steak with a few peas on the side. You can have, like, you know, lots of vegetables and a smaller bit of meat. You know, don't have to make meat the hero of every meal. And so, yeah, to me it's just it was pretty clear that there was great benefit in just eating lots of fresh fruit and vegetables. And then beyond that, you know, you might get some specialist recommendations. I mean, I think there's good evidence around things like a Japanese diet or a Mediterranean diet, you know, eating fresh, seasonal, local food. You know, the Japanese are into green tea and good quality soy products like tofu and tempeh. And then I think the Mediterranean diet is, again, lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, olive oil. And I'm not a nutritionist, I hasten to add, but going to see a nutritionist or a dietitian, I think, is a really good thing, like seeing an exercise physiologist. So having a bit of an allied health team, you know, getting your care plan and seeing an exercise physiologist and a nutritionist and, you know, then choosing what else you want to add under a sort of from that suite of allied health specialists you can choose from. But getting advice, I think, early on is a really good thing, and that's what I did. I saw a nutritionist and they sort of set me on my way. And then I started really enjoying it, like eating and cooking good food and feeling the benefits again. You know, once you start feeling the benefits of these things, it becomes self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
And I know what it's like because I've fluctuated, you know, like I call it discipline fatigue. You know, it's hard to always do the right thing. But I know how much better I feel when I kind of get back closer to what I call sort of best practice.
Yeah.
And at the moment, I feel like I'm on a really good program of eating well and exercising and meditating and the rest of it.
We'll
get to that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, you know, Declan, because diet is something the patients are naturally curious about because we get that question a lot.
Yeah.
You know, when we're booking a patient for surgery, they'll often say, well, is there anything I need to avoid eating or is there anything I should specifically be eating? And that can be a really hard question to answer because we don't know what their diet is currently like. We don't really particularly have any expertise in nutrition. And I've always sort of relied on the heart healthy diet is a prostate healthy diet kind of thing. But I think, you know, referring patients, if they're truly interested in doing something about that, to a nutritionist is very helpful.
And also because there's a fair bit of misinformation because patients will come in with printouts saying, I've read that I must eliminate meat and do this and do that. And we all have stories of this where patients have gone on extreme diets or lifestyle measures and ended up unwell, you know. We don't want to frighten people about that, but you know, and I have a very open mind on what you might read, that you want to take some control yourself and say, I've read this and I've read that. But you do have to have some advice sometimes. And for example, I remember a patient of mine during COVID who turned up for his surgery. He was due for surgery and he looked terrible in the holding bay. We're there and the nurses said, this man doesn't look well, he's 58, and you know, and he'd gone on an extreme diet for 7 weeks between us seeing him and booking him for surgery. And basically ended up in kidney failure. We assessed him, admitted him, you know, and he had just done an extreme diet and ended up with all sorts of metabolic issues that were correctable, thankfully. But it was because he read something and, you know, quit work and obsessively went on this extreme diet. So,
I think and there is, a lot of extreme kind of spurious dietary advice out there. And I think, you know, like a lot of these things, the answer's in the middle way, you know.
But I think one of the most dangerous things we can say to patients in the lead up to, say, surgery is go away and lose some weight. You know, sometimes, you know, the situation that you describe could exactly happen. So it's not just enough to say that, but they do need the adequate support and resources to be able to do that in a safe way.
And I'll admit, I reckon I came out of the gates too hard when I was first diagnosed because I was so determined to do whatever I could to stay healthy. I think I lost 15 kilos in a month, which is pretty drastic. And people around me were freaking out, you know, because when you get a cancer diagnosis and you suddenly drop all this weight, it just raises all these fears in people. But I felt amazing. But I've since moderated my diet and I think I've come back to a pretty sensible centre, you know. And I enjoy food, you know, I enjoy cooking and eating and shopping for food. And so, I've just become more about the pleasure of eating well and listening to your body. And once you kind of have a reasonably clean diet, I think your body kind of tells you what it needs. And if my body's telling me I need to eat a bit of meat, I eat a bit of meat.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's cooking meat and I'm just like, oh my God. You know, maybe I'm lacking iron.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just try and be reasonably. I describe myself now as a flexitarian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think when you start putting a bit of focus into it, you do realise that a lot of foods that you eat is not because you enjoy it, it's because of convenience or ease or, you know. So when you actually actually changing your diet doesn't mean that you're being restrictive in any way. It just means that you're eating the things that you enjoy and are actually good for you.
Yeah. And I've become one of those insufferable people that posts photos of my food on Instagram, you know.
We've seen that. That's great.
Yeah. And look, I think on these latter two topics, on the exercise and the meditation, for patients starting energy and deprivation therapy, it's particularly so because you will put on weight and you won't feel much like exercise in these months after you start ADT. So getting the strategy in early rather than a year later, isn't that part of the message you have to people is to say, think about these things. And guess what? Your quality of life will be maintained, maybe even improved.
Yeah.
Because maybe your lifestyle was not so healthy. And it doesn't have to be extreme, but I think that's the message for clinicians, loved ones, and patients themselves out there, is that these simple strategies should be thought about. And even if you're already on ADT, go back and think about this, look for help or self-help. Absolutely. And we'll put some links and follow Tim on his social channels. He's actually really good to follow because he's constantly pushing out other resource and links as well.
Yeah, so
we'll
do that with him.
And get some recipe ideas, right?
Yeah. And it's a pleasure. It's good fun you know, when you get into it. And I've learned to just take delight in shopping and preparing and eating good food.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about deprivation.
No.
Yeah, it can be a really positive thing. And, you know, when you get a diagnosis, like so much of your world has been turned upside down and it can all be feel pretty grim. But just to get these positive messages right at the outset that these are all these things you can do for yourself. You can be proactive. You can make life better. You can manage side effects effectively with a few tools in your toolkit. Yeah.
And then the last one, which I think is one of the most challenging ones, especially when you're faced with a diagnosis like that or any kind of chronic illness, and something that can feel beyond your control is sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you manage?
Well, I think that? You know, we spoke about this last time, is that the beauty of the MEDS acronym is that they support each other.
Yeah.
And so if you're doing all those other things, meditation, exercise, eating well, they all help support good sleep. And then there's the well understood principles of kind of good sleep hygiene, you know, like not being on your mobile phone, getting off all tech and screens at least half an hour, ideally an hour before going to bed, you know, treating your bedroom and your bed as a bit of a sanctuary, that it's just for sleep. You don't sit in bed watching TV or working on your laptop, that, you know, you're kind of giving your body the signal, you know, and having a bit of a ritual around it. You know, when I get ready for bed and go to bed, my body is preparing for sleep. And I think your body sort of starts to respond to those signals and messages. And there are people who know much more about that kind of whole world of sleep therapy than I. But, yeah, it's worked pretty effectively, those sort of general principles. And then the other thing that I think has been really helpful for me with sleep has been medicinal cannabis. And I could talk to you all about that at great length.
Yeah.
But I've
We've read
on,
the chapter in the book.
Yeah,
yeah. Very good.
And I've been on clinical trials for medicinal cannabis, you know, so I've had it prescribed by a doctor and it's been really useful. And sleep, I think, is one of the areas where it's been most useful for me.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, I do think it's a challenge because all those things that you mentioned about sleep hygiene, it can be people can be very resistant to do that because it is, we're creatures of habit and we're so used to doing some last minute work or sending off a few emails before bed. But I think it's only when you start to see the benefits, you just force yourself to do it and you start to see the benefits, that you realize actually there is something good that can come out of it.
And also when you sort of understand the principles and the science behind it, like circadian rhythms, you know, that once upon a time before technology and electric lighting, we lived by the rhythms of nature. And when the sun went down, we prepared for sleep. And when the sun came up, we were awakened. And because we have unnatural light available to us 24/7, you know, we lose touch with those circadian rhythms. And so getting up with the sun and, you know, winding down at the end of the day and getting, trying to feel that natural cycle of the day. You know, I love getting up early and watching the sunrise and, yeah, slowing down at the end of the day. And so I've taken my cancer diagnosis, kind of this carte blanche, to just do what feels good for me. And if there's a silver lining to that sort of diagnosis, it's like no one's going to quibble with you,
yeah,
you know, looking after yourself. No one's going to go, geez, you're being a bit self-indulgent, yeah, you know.
8 hours of sleep, are you serious? Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, we were talking a little bit about this off air, and it's that, you know, these are things that you can get better and better at.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't expect to start any of these things and be immediately good at it or enjoy it.
Mm.
But the more you persist and the more you train yourself, you know, just like any other skill, these can be developed.
Yeah. I've heard someone, I can't remember where it was, talking about this idea of being sort of sleep hungry, you know, and getting to the end of the day. And it's something I've started to experience, not through a deliberate strategy, but just like it'll get to 9 o'clock at night. I could be out socially and it's like, oh, I just start thinking about my bed, like get me down back to bed.
Yeah.
You know, and if you have that real positive association with just like resting your head at the end of the day and having a really comfortable bed and a really nice pillow and, you know, just really treat yourself, that, you know, you deserve this kind of nurturing, pampering experience of, you know, and we know that sleep is one of the great determinants of our health. You know, inadequate sleep can lead to all kinds of chronic health issues. So if you've already got a diagnosis like that, like making sleep a priority, again, I think is a no-brainer. And a pleasure, you know, not a chore. I think that's
just treat it like you have a spa appointment every night at 10 o'clock, you know.
Yeah. The problem in this particular spa, though, is a lot of our urology patients have problems that get them
that's
up at night.
True.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, you talked about that in the book. I think you had a TURP, didn't you, at
diagnosis? Yeah.
But but there are, you know, I think your messages are really, really important. But part of it might be, well, you know, how is your bladder behaving, or what about leakage issues, and so on? Because when you've got prostate cancer, whether you've had treatment for early cancer or you've got very advanced cancer, unfortunately there are waterworks issues, and get chatting to your friendly urologist. Often there are things we can do, sometimes there are limits to what we can do, but if that's what's interrupting sleep, we can address some of it. But I think part of your messages, Tim, is that there are other things and other strategies that may be underlying it, because it's not always the bladder or the prostate or this that's causing it.
And I mean, I have to get up during the night like every other man with prostate cancer, you know, but I've kind of gotten good at getting back to sleep and like just like, I don't know, not turning lots of lights on when you get up. I mean, you don't want to trip over in the dark. I don't want to create hazards for people, but you know, I just try and do it quite sort of without fully waking up in a sense, you know, stumble to the bathroom and do what I need to do and stumble back to bed. And then I also feel like I've got quite good at just lying in bed. And it's something I got from Vipassana meditation retreats, because when you meditate for 10 hours a day, when you actually go to sleep at the end of the day, weirdly, because you've just sat in stillness for 10 hours, your mind can get quite busy and you can have trouble sleeping unexpectedly. And their advice is, if you're having trouble sleeping, just rest. Don't lie awake going, oh God, I can't sleep, I'm going to be so tired tomorrow. It's like you're lying down, just rest and treat it like a lying meditation. And I feel like sometimes I've almost blurred the line between my waking and sleep states, and so if I'm not immediately drifting off to sleep, I'm just resting, and eventually I'll fall asleep, and I'm not gonna toss and turn and worry about the fact that I haven't fallen asleep. That's a bit self-defeating. So a lot of this stuff's just practice, and it might sound daunting at first, but I just sort of try and go gently on myself, and most of these things eventually start to kind of fall into place.
And like you said, all of those things support each other. So, you know, if you take care of your diet a bit better and your alcohol intake, you know, you will limit the number of times you may get up in the middle of the night.
Yep.
But that's not to say that if there is a real problem, you may have to complement meds with some pharmaceutical meds. That might help, you know.
Yeah, it's a marriage of, modern medicine and I guess what we would call allied health and integrative oncology, or however we want to talk about it.
So that's meds. But one of the other things we wanted to talk to you about before we finished, Tim, was you mentioned you're doing this creative writing PhD, and the book Patting the Shark was part of it. And I know before you came down to Melbourne this weekend for your dad, for Ian's 90th birthday, because that's why he's here. Ian has flown over from Perth, and you've had a great family weekend. But just before you came down, you were having the review part of your thesis presented at the university in Queensland. And you've written here about how your project involves presenting the case that language and storytelling have an important role to play in improving the lives of people living with cancer. I'm reading from the summary from the thesis, but that's another area you have a lot of interest in, is the role of writing as a form, bibliotherapy, I think you called it. Writing and writing workshops. Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we wrap up?
I mean, this was all sort of serendipity, really. I mean, I had the experience myself of writing the book and feeling like it was cathartic, because the book and the PhD began just as personal writing therapy. I'd wake up in the morning and do what's sometimes called morning pages. A woman named Julia Cameron wrote a book called The Artist's Way, and she talks about just doing morning pages, just moving the pen across the page with no thought of what's coming out, just kind of stream of consciousness as a way of processing life experiences. And I found that incredibly helpful. And then over time, I felt like I'd built up this sort of suite of little vignettes and anecdotes about my cancer journey that had just felt really cathartic, really soothing. Catherine Devini, who's one of the writers who's done a lot of work in this area, she calls it like a self-sourcing pudding, like learning that you can actually self-soothe as a cancer patient is a wonderful tool. And I guess a lot of these strategies we talk about that is developing the ability to self-soothe. And I think writing and language and therapeutic reading or bibliotherapy are other tools that can be useful for people dealing with a diagnosis. So the book began for me as writing therapy. And then when I started getting feedback from readers about the book, it was obvious to me how many of them had got a sort of cathartic effect from reading the book. And then I discovered this whole world of bibliotherapy or therapeutic reading. And I just thought, well, these are just other tools available to people, that it's not going to suit everyone. But if you're someone who has a love of language and reading, then this, you know, it's not one size fits all. It's kind of finding horses for courses. So recognizing the person in front of you as a patient and what their inclinations are, and sort of finding the tools that might best suit them. And then I got the opportunity to run some writing workshops through the Byron Writers Festival. And they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I want to run workshops on writing therapy. And I just had this amazing response from the participants. Like, at the end of the day, people were just on such a high and so grateful. And I, to be honest, I felt like I was kind of winging it a bit. Like, this works for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to work for anyone else, but this is what I did. And I'd had a few little guided meditations as well as part of the workshop. And this wasn't for cancer patients specifically. It was just anyone felt like they had something to process. And it just, it's probably the most enthusiastic response I've had to anything I've ever done in my working life, to be honest. Like, I got the participant feedback forms back from the Byron Writers Festival, and it was just really obvious to me that there was something here. And so then I started looking at the research, and there's a whole lot of studies around writing therapy and bibliotherapy. Not so much in a cancer-specific context, there's some, but a lot of it is just dealing with depression or social isolation or trauma and anxiety, which are all things that affect cancer patients. So why shouldn't it work in a cancer-specific context? And Peter McCallum have done a lot of this work through their Wellbeing Centre as well, with Catherine Devini and, you know, Geraldine McDonald, who runs the Wellbeing Centre, and their participant feedback forms, the results are incredible. People love this work.
And does it matter what you write, or is it just the act of writing? I mean, can you write a short story, for instance, and get the same effect?
I mean, there's lots of different theories around it. One is taking this kind of stepped approach where you write about your trauma fictionally in the third person, and then you write about your trauma and it's sort of non-fiction. It's your story, but you're still writing it in the third person, and then you write about it personally in the first person. So you sort of step your way up to writing more personally. And then Catherine talks about this effect where people get really into the craft and skill acquisition, and they're loving that whole process, and it sort of softens the trauma of the actual content because they're so enjoying the process.
Yeah.
And so they're talking about things that are quite grim, but because they're having this sort of positive experience of acquiring new skills and getting a sense of achievement and learning this craft, that it takes some of the sting out of what they're actually dealing with.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it fascinating.
The conundrum is more, well, how do I describe that event rather than I went through this event?
Yeah, I want to make this piece of writing as beautiful as I can. And then there's a lot of research. I mean, I've worked quite closely with Professor Susan Chambers, oncopsychologist, who's, you know, really highly regarded in her field. And she says these effects kind of mimic what she calls acceptance commitment therapy or meaning-based psychotherapy, that it's helping patients reach a point of acceptance and make meaning of their diagnosis. So that to me is super exciting. And if I can be a part of that and use my skill set as a writer and my experience as a cancer patient and help other people, then that's a great outcome.
Yeah. And it's kind of, it's sort of like meditation and counselling and psychotherapy and everything in one thing, which you can do entirely yourself.
Yeah,
you
and it's so easily deliverable, you know, because we struggle to meet the unmet psychosocial challenges of a cancer diagnosis because they can seem, you know, so overwhelming, and, you know, having the resources for everyone to get what they need, you know, writing therapy is pretty easy to deliver, and then people can become self-soothing, you know, that self-sourcing pudding.
I get it. Yeah.
What a great tool to have available to people with a bit of encouragement and a little bit of guidance. They can go away and kind of be their own therapist, you know.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very inspiring.
And just an anecdote before I finish about the writing side of it, Tim. There's a patient of mine who, like yourself, was diagnosed about 50. I remember very, very well. It's 12 years ago with metastatic prostate cancer. His PSA was over 1,000. I remember it was just a week before Christmas. I got this referral and got him in. And he writes a blog about this. He's still doing fantastic 12 years later.
Wow.
So writing, I think, this blog for him is in part of it. But I've read his blogs and you can feel his emotions in the blogs as well, good days and bad days. And again, I find it very insightful as a clinician, seeing what he writes about the experience of coming to the hospital and getting a PSA level and so on. But the other thing that he writes about in the blog, because he's a very keen cyclist, is the role of exercise, velo therapy, as he calls it. So he's convinced that and he like cycles hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kilometers a week.
Fantastic.
You know, PSA was 1,000, he's on ADT for 12-13 years on another drug now as well, but PSA is still well and truly smashed, like yours, I should say, because you do post about this, but your PSA is still going great, thankfully. So the strategy is going well, the cancer strategy is going well, the meds are going well, and it's great to see you, and thank you for coming in and sharing.
Absolute pleasure. Really grateful for the opportunity and just grateful that I'm still in good health, and you know, medical science and everything else that I've found that's helped, it's a really happy marriage and collaboration, the way I look at it. Yeah.
I got to say, you know, in your book, when I read it, the thing that still gives me goosebumps when I remember it is the story of how you got your diagnosis, and you give that alternate scenario. And I think, you know, with everything that you've done over the last year and the strategies that you've developed, I really do think as clinicians, if we embrace it, we can get a little bit closer to that alternative scenario where patients don't walk out feeling like they've been hit by a truck.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, given those tools to self-soothe and, be able to come proactive about managing their own health and well-being.
Amazing, Tim.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Tim. Well done. Patting the Shark is the book. It's totally fantastic. Treat yourself to it coming up to Christmas. That's all we have time for on this fantastic episode.
Yeah,
it was really enjoyable. And thanks very much to our gold partners, Mundi Pharma, for supporting this initiative as well. We'll be back again very soon. Do get in touch. Do rate, like, subscribe, all that sort of stuff. And reach out if you want us to cover anything in particular. Thank you very much from us. Thank you.
Thank you.